So today we're still wrapping up the post-Revelation chapter 16, seven last plagues study, by continuing to look at a few other pictures that are related. And then we will just finish off this page 8 on the notes, as it were. And so let me ask, were there any questions left over from last week? Sister Carrie.
Do you remember when there was an exchange between Sister Sister Cheryl and yourself, and you listed together seven last plagues, or the seven truths? It's hard to explain what that was, but it was like you said, can you name them off the top of your head? And she listed them for us. And I tried to make that list later, and I can't remember exactly what went down there. So,
okay. Well, do you have the notes that we sent out on Revelation 16 a couple months ago?
Is that the one that I asked you for last week, and you sent? Is that the same?
Probably.
It's about six. It's 9 pages long, that one?
Sounds about right.
Okay. I looked through today. I couldn't find that exactly on there. But I guess I should listen to the video or the audio over again. I'll find it that way. So, over, salt. Sorry about that.
Well, no, that's all right. The thing is that in those notes, the first page, Revelation 16, unedited,
yes.
It says, Revelation 16, verse 3, and in bold, every human souls die.
Uh-huh.
That's the plaguing truth. In other words, human souls are not immortal. That's the plaguing truth.
Okay.
And in Revelation 4 through 6, that plaguing truth is that it exposes the erroneous doctrine of a hell of eternal torment. Will demonstrate that that's not true.
Okay. It's the headings.
Well, it's the points of truth that are in each of these plagues.
Mm-hmm.
In Revelation 16, 8 and 9, it demonstrates that there's a ransom for all and that it will include restitution for all, and demonstrates that the philosophy or the understanding of the ransom demonstrates that Jesus and God are separate, because God cannot die, that Jesus had to die. So that disproves the Trinity. And then in the Revelation 16, 10 and 11, the plaguing truth there is it exposes that the papacy and the line of popes, are all their claims and titles are false, and their counterfeit kingdom will be fully revealed as a great deception. And in Revelation 16:12, the plague there, the plaguing truth, exposes the error of the thought of a church and state confederacy, that this is God's kingdom now. And then in Revelation 16:17 and 21, the plague there poured upon the air demonstrates that Satan and the fallen angels have been behind all the gross falsehoods and deceptive errors of doctrine and practice throughout the age. That we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but wicked spirits in exalted places, for example. And then it culminates that there's the hail that beats down every man. And the hail is hard, frozen water, or hard truths, as we say. So the culminating effect of the seven last plaguing truths will be that the truth that exposes these errors will beat down every Christian, nominal Christian, will have to recognize that their belief system through papacy or Protestantism has been wrong. And that will humble them, get them ready to receive the truth eventually. But before they receive the truth, it actually causes them to retaliate against these false systems and the oppression they endured under that final church and state arrangement that limited their liberties. That 1 hour in which they oppress people, in the name of God, that will be exposed. And like the French Revolution, the people will rise up and tear those systems down. So Sister Carrie, is that helpful?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Okay. Sister Cheryl, do you have anything on that? You were brought up in this.
You brought it up very well. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I was reading the notes. So, all right. The faintest ink is better than the best memory, more so as we get older. Okay. Were there any other comments or questions left over, brother? Okay. So I think where we're at is that I had these few pictures that have been brought out in our discussion that we said, well, we'll just hold on to those and we'd get to them. My list shows that we thought we'd consider Isaiah 23 in part. I've got a verse in Revelation 10 I thought we'd revisit. We went through Revelation 10. I thought we'd just touch on that for a moment. And then we'd take a quick look at Ezekiel 9 and 10 in part. And then there was Gideon's ban has been brought out several times. And then Jezebel's destruction at the hand of Jehu and those with him. So I thought that we would take a look at you. Take a look at you. That's why. Take a look at those. That's what I get for flipping between the chat and my screen. Did anyone have another picture that they thought we needed to look at that we haven't talked on that might have a relationship to this? I mean, I know we can keep coming up with probably a number more, but just want to make sure we're not leaving out someone's favorite. Okay. So let's take a look then at Isaiah 23. And Brother Chris, I think you brought this out a week or two ago as an example. And so if we turn there, if you would like to read, you could pick and choose as you want, but otherwise I would just say pick up with verse 15 unless you wanted to go earlier.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Isaiah 23 verses 15 through 18 in particular is what I have highlighted. And I'll read that real quick. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as a harlot. Take a harp, go about the city, thou harlot. Thou hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs that thou mayest be remembered. And it shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. It shall not be treasured nor laid up. For her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord to eat sufficiently and to the durable clothing. So, when we were talking about really the time of the end and, it sounded like Babylon had particularly the papal line, this is Tyre, had come to an end because Napoleon broke the back of papacy, but she struggled on, and after 1914, the collapse of the monarchical dynasties of kings collapsed, and those that weren't ousted from their thrones abdicated, and so really the fall of the blue bloods, as it were, came to an end, and because we know that the 1220 years lease of Gentile times ended, the lease ended in 1914. And so, and then World War I broke out. That was all part of what caused all that to happen. And World War I ended basically, something would say like 1918, but you know, America got in right at the end. And so there was really like a cleanup of World War I, and that ended in 1919 particularly. So that brings us to the very beginning of this. It shall come to pass in that day. And typically when Isaiah refers to in that day, it's during the Lord's presence. So it's in the seventh millennial. So that gives us a good time frame. And then it talks about this Tyre. And then we see that Tyre is the same as the harlot. And she shall sing for 70 years. So 1919, if we just plug a number into that, 1919 plus 70 years brings it to 1989. So what event took place in 1989 that we would look at, and what was the biggest event of the time, of the decades, was the fall of the Iron Curtain and the liberation of all those, a further breaking down of the countries of Europe, sort of grinding into power. And we saw that the Pope was in the headlines almost every day. He was like the big one. And Reagan, Ronald Reagan, president of the greatest power in the world, and Nancy, Nancy, I just had her name, the prime minister of England, those two and the Pope were really instrumental in manipulating the events to really take Russia down. And the Pope was once again elevated in the sight of everybody in the world. And so here she is, the Pope, the line of popes once again reestablished, has authority. People are now, he's dealing with the kings of the earth, England and the United States, and then all the other states that are, all the other countries that are in coalition with the U.S., all looking at the Pope once again, that he's the man. And we see that hasn't, that has continued. He's still singing and, still singing along. So that's kind of a long answer to these few verses. I apologize for that, but that's what I got. Over.
No, that's very good. Very helpful. And the name might have been Margaret Thatcher for England.
Yeah, Thatcher.
And it was, of course, our Pope John Paul II, the Polish Pope. And Brother Chris, could you emphasize a little bit on that verse 17 where it says, "And she shall turn to her hire"? Do you have the note from like leasers or something on that word?
Well, I don't have another translation on that. I have it return.
Right.
Return to her hire. In other words, there was a time when she was not practicing, even though in reality she was, but technically, she was not elevated to where she was. The kings of the earth were really embracing the papal advice and all that. So I just have a cross-reference to the Revelation 18:5 that we will be looking at. Well, this is like the only scriptures that we have that go beyond 1914. 1914, most of our prophetic pictures at the ends of the Gentile times, we have a bunch of them, and we're going to be looking at that First Kings and others, but 1914, Pastor Russell and everybody else thought, okay, that's where all the scriptural prophetic testimonies end. And I believe it was Brother Bednarz that brought this out, and pretty keen plug-in for him that, yes, even as late as 1989, we still have prophetic testimony being brought out in scripture. And I'm sure there's more that the Lord just hasn't turned the light on yet. Over.
Okay, very good. We appreciate that. Yes, she shall return to her hire, showing a coming back, a return after a 70-year hiatus. And yes, Brother Walter Bednar is a faithful brother. And there was one other thing you said before. I was going to call on Sister Cheryl. It escapes me, but we'll have more comments here. Sister Cheryl.
I have the note that 1984 began the ambassadorship of the USA with papacy, but I'm not really sure what all that entails. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? Over.
Yes, I can, because it's just two suggestions on when the period of the 70 years covered. Brother Chris well brought out the one. But let's hold on to that in case Sister Alice wants to comment about that.
No, I had the same question because 70 plus 1914 is 84. It's not 89.
Right. That's correct. So there's two views. There's two interpretations of when to start and end the 70 years. Brother Walter, would anyone like to explain the two views? Brother Chris really covered the one, but I don't want to, if someone else want to explain it? Okay. Brother Walter Bednar's, his suggestion was it was 1914 plus 70 years to 1984. His thinking was that the expression in verse... let me pick it out. Yeah, verse 15, I skipped right over it. It shall come to pass in that day. Well, we think of the 1,000-year day of our Lord beginning in 1874. It's true. But it says, Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king, and after the end of the 7 years shall Tyre sing. So the interpretation becomes, who's the one king? What's the 70 years of this one king before the harlot returns to her hire? Papacy comes back into prominence. Well, Brother Walter thought the days of one king, that king was Jesus, and he became the one king at the end of the Gentile times, when the Gentile kings, their lease of dominion was over, it had expired, 1914, end of the Gentile times. So those kings, Gentile kings, are no more, their eviction process begins. So the only one king God would, recognize as King Jesus, even though, of course, he had been present since 1874, he returned as a king, but it talks about how, bear with me, remember in Daniel 2, it says that the Lord would set up a kingdom in the days of these kings. And we have that. Our Lord Jesus started to set up his kingdom while the earthly kings during the last portion of the Gentile times were still allowed to have power. But by 1914, they were evicted. Their lease had expired. And so the one king is Jesus. The process of evicting all these kings is still ongoing, indeed. So, 70 years from 1914 brings you to 1984, and as was brought out, that was under Ronald Reagan, the United States instituted its ambassadorship with the Vatican, with John Paul II, And the primary reason for that was they were working with the papacy and the United States were trying to defeat communism in the sense of freeing Eastern Europe from communism. You remember there was Gorbachev, there was the work of Glasnost, there were the work of, remember, the Russian refuseniks, there was Reagan calling for the breaking down of the wall in Berlin, which Brother Chris referred to, which actually happened in 1989. But between 1984 and 1989 was the process of destabilizing communism in these Eastern Bloc countries. And then you remember the Eastern Bloc countries fell like dominoes. Czechoslovakia, Romania, Moldova, Poland got freed up, and East Germany, really, it was extremely dramatic part of history. So that's the one interpretation. The other interpretation that some brethren promoted, 1919, with the Bolshevik Revolution, through 1989, with the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, the one king is communism. The one king was communism. The days of one king, the 70 years, in which the harlot was out of favor in world government in any way, came to an end. And Pope John Paul II, the first Polish pope, was such a charismatic figure that he's really the one that went, remember, he went to Poland, and he was a Polish pope. He went to Poland, and the communists didn't know what to do with him, because when he arrived, the people, you remember Lech Walesa, and the shippers union, the loading dock union, how they had rallied the people to resist communism. And I don't remember the communist guy's name, but he was in trouble because he couldn't really bring tanks out against the Pope because the people are all there loving him. And he was a Polish Pope. So it was a doubly great thing. And he was pretty much a nice guy to top it all off. Very personable. And by the way, he made an album. He literally sang to go along with the more important symbolic aspect. And he was an actor. And believe it or not, he had been hidden in one of the brethren's homes in Poland for a number of years. So he even was aware of the truth. Sadly, he didn't embrace it. But anyway, we could go on about that, but those are the two views. But the key is, in my mind, they both end in the 1980s. So we're right there. Either way, we're right there with this dramatic change. And okay, that's it. Any other comments on this? So this was brought out in relation to the Seven Last Plagues study to demonstrate that we have a time prophecy that Brother Russell didn't explain. We have a time prophecy. Brother Chris brought out it's either 1914 on or 1919 onward, but it's one that the Lord apparently didn't bring to Brother Russell's mind, or Brother Russell didn't have a way to interpret it, so he let it alone, which is smart. But for us, we're all taking it as a great encouragement because we see that it helps confirm that there's time prophecy demonstrating that there would be an extended time after 1914. Whichever way you like to look at this, it's after 1914. So That's how we got to this. Anyone have any comments on this? Any further, or should we move along? Ruth? No, Brother Dan.
I had a quote marked in my margin on verse 18.
Yeah.
From reprint 38:28. And it's a paragraph that would cast some light on, "For merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing." Can I read it?
Yeah, please.
The churches now are trying to emphasize points of agreement rather than of difference, and are working harmoniously together for moral and humanitarian ends. Theology and doctrine have been sent to the rear, and it is recognized that the true work of the church is here and now in making this world a happier and better place for everybody to live in on a basis of unselfishness and brotherly love. In this effort, agnostic and churchmen, Jews and infidels are working together, and what a man believes is regarded as of comparatively little consequence. So he's not commenting on Isaiah 23 so much, but the fact that today the hire of the papacy and her daughters are considered like humanitarian. They're very, they're put in a very good light. You know, they're helping people, and they brought down communism, and they're looked at as if what they believe doesn't make any difference. It's what that they're supporting human rights and things like that. So it's kind of the same type of light. Over.
Yes, and we can all, at least here, we can all, you know, recognize that there are it's called Catholic Social Services. And they receive government tax dollars to assist in distributing temporal assistance to people who come to their services. And the government has been actively involved since the 1980s using these the papacy as a distribution for tax dollars, humanitarian assistance is being brought out because they're in place. They have their own personnel. They have their offices. They have their networks. And so it's something that has been used. So the papacy isn't acting like they did in the days of the Dark Ages, where they tax the people just to keep all the money to enhance the Vatican and St. Peter's and things. But rather now they portray themselves as using their funds, which is really what they collect from other people or governments, to distribute to those in need. And it puts them in a better position, like what Ruth just read. All right, Brother Dan.
Yeah, Brother Rick, in connection with the rising up of the papacy, we read in Revelation 18:21, and a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone. So in my understanding, papacy has to be raised up. They have to come back to power and influence. And so there'll be we see that 70 years and beyond, the rising up of the papacy and power and influence in the world, like former days, not exactly like former days, but as the verse continues, rise like a great millstone and cast into the sea, saying, "Thus with violence shall the great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all." So here, it shows the final destruction after, the papacy, is raised up, as we've been discussing. Over.
Okay. Very good. So true. Thank you. Sister Els.
Tigris in Lebanon And Lebanon is north of Israel and one of the Arab countries. So is this Lebanon today as affiliated with papacy? Question over.
I don't know of a particular, I mean, I'm sure there's a minimal connection, but I don't know of something pronounced. I don't think that the Tyre here is meant to be taken literally in context. We didn't go through all this context. We have, at other times when we've discoursed on this chapter, but I'll just point out one verse that seems to bring some of this together. It's in Isaiah 23, verse 8. Who hath taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honorable of the earth? The Lord of hosts hath proposed it to stain the pride of all glory and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. And it goes on. But the crowning city, if Tyre represents papacy, if we have that right, papacy bestowed the crowns on the kings during her reign. But of course, that was pre-1914. That ended in 1799. But one really has to go through all these verses to convince themselves that Tyre here is meant to be symbolic. I guess that's all I have. Did anyone have anything else on that?
I have a question because in Lebanon, Tyre is mentioned in Psalm 83 as being one of the countries against Israel at war. That's in Psalm 83, verse 7. It mentions it. So I was just wondering how... I mean, I agree that it's papacy here, but in a literal way, Lebanon is at war with Israel. So that's why I'm trying to figure out why we would say, how would we say that papacy is at war with Israel? I'm just trying to tie that in. I'm not sure I understand it to explain it. Over.
Well, to my mind, they're just two different pictures. Just sometimes it's literal Babylon, and sometimes in the pictures it's symbolic Babylon. And so in Psalm 83, I believe it's literal Tyre, which is in Lebanon, as you pointed out, and Islamic. And in Isaiah 23, I believe it's symbolic Tyre, representative of papacy. But before I comment further, I don't want to comment over the top of others. Let's see here. Ruth?
I was just going to refer to reading Ezekiel 27 and 28 because those both of those chapters are all about Tyre being, starting out as papacy and then the king of Tyre himself being Satan. So it seems like it would be more of a, it's saying things that really wouldn't seem like it would apply to the literal Tyre, like, because thine heart is lifted up and thou hast said, I am a God. I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas, yet thou art a man and not God. Though thou set thine heart as the heart of God. Doesn't sound like literal Tyre, like in that particular place. So it's just a reference. Ezekiel 28.
Yes, you read Ezekiel 28 too. Thank you. I fully concur. This is the Prince of Tyre. And it's the papacy, the line of popes. And in Ezekiel 28:12, the king of Tyre, which we all think is Satan. And in Ezekiel 27, it really coordinates, dovetails into Revelation 18 with the merchants of the sea. And I'm not sure if the class, as a class we studied this, but we've discoursed on the two tires, and the one literal, and the one as it represents papacy, and how it coordinates. But kind of have to leave that there on that. Ruth, no further comment? Hands up. Okay, Sister Theodora.
Just want to share one fact. In Lebanon, there is a Christian minority. I know that from the fact when I was student, there were two brothers who were studying medical science in Bulgaria. They were Christians, Catholics, and they belonged to a high class in Lebanon. Their father was something in the government high position. Just, I don't know when this Christian minority occurred in Lebanon. Just as a fact, I want to share that. Thank you.
Yes, that's true. Thank you for bringing that out. It's true. We recognize that there are Christians in Lebanon. It's true. Okay. I don't know, Sister Alice, I could say at least hopefully that's some food for thought. Appreciate the good question.
You're
welcome. Other comments on Isaiah 23? Brother Dan.
And just a simple thought. If you read the context of Isaiah 23, leading up to verse 15 and onward, it seems to be symbolic and not literal. Over.
Yes. I certainly agree with that. Okay. Any other comments here, Isaiah 23? Okay, the next one I had on this list that I've brought out, it's just in Revelation 10. This is just a quick visit. Revelation 10, as I mentioned, we had studied it verse by verse along the way, of course. And without trying to recreate that whole study, it's not really necessary. I just wanted to, again, remind ourselves what we had talked about there. And so, excuse me, Sister Gina, could you read for us in Revelation 10, verse 3 and 4? Just, yeah, 3 and 4.
And he cried with a great voice, as a lion roareth. And when he cried, the seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up the things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not.
All right. So, we're just jumping right in the middle. We're concluded chapter 16, which means this was long ago we went through it. But did you have any opening comments for us, Sister Gina?
Well, let's see. Well, I know we're talking about the seven thunders, but now I got to remember what that was all about. And maybe go on to someone else. Let me find that in my notes. So I have something.
That's fair enough.
Thank you.
Yeah, certainly. So who's picking up here on what we might have discussed there? Brother Chris.
Well, the seven thunders are controversies. And let's see here. He cried with a loud voice, a lion roared. So this is after or during the Millerite movement, and really all these controversies are breaking out, and the scriptures are all, but we're told to seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered and write them not. In other words, that the church, the true church, is not to be concerned with all this. You know, stay focused on the truth that you know. That's this controversy of the plagues and stuff. Just watch and pray, and that's what I remember out of that little section.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Certainly thunders are controversies. It creates controversies. But let's develop this a little bit more. Brother Dan.
Brother Rick, I remember from our recent Daniel study, we compared Daniel 12 and Revelation 10, and we said that these two verses we just read, 3 and 4, were a parenthesis, because the 10th chapter is in the sixth trumpet. So the seven thunders, and we also, we looked at verse 7 in Revelation 10, which reads, "But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants and prophets." So, the events of the seventh trumpet, were still to come, because this is the sixth trumpet period. So it was sealed up because it wasn't the time to, for the seventh trumpet, the trumpet for the seventh stage of the church in the harvest message to be understood, by the saints. Over.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you. Ruth, so you took your hand down, but what were you going to comment?
Pretty much the same thing, that it wasn't time for these seven messages of truth that were going to disrupt all society during the seventh angel and during the plagues. It wasn't time for them to be written yet, broadcast yet. Over.
Okay, very good. So, a further comment. Sister Molly.
I just had a note for the seven thunders that they were the seven last plagues. So I don't know if I took down the proper note, but that's what I have in my notes. Over.
To my mind, that appeals. Because the seven last plagues are going to create the controversy of controversies. Very good. Brother Mark, same thought? You had your hand up?
Sister Molly answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. So when we look at the verses, these two verses, and as Brother Dan brought out, we do think they're parenthetical, but we think they're here for a reason. The reason is that the time period of these verses in chapter 10, we think it refers to the sixth trumpet period, but toward the end where we had the French Revolution. And that was what we were connecting to Daniel 12 with the French Revolution, the end of the 1260 days or years. But the French Revolution was an earthquake, tells us in Revelation 11, again in the sixth trumpet period, that one-tenth of the city fell in this earthquake. And that was France in the French Revolution. One-tenth of the 10 parts of Christendom, if you will, Europe. But the insertion of these seven thunders, but being told not to write them, was because the French Revolution and the time of the end, 1799, was only to be limited in scope, because there was still much work that the Lord had to do before you would have the complete end of the entire city as we like to say, when the other 9/10 of the city would fall in the greatest earthquake, which we read about in Revelation 16 as a result of the 7 last plagues being poured out. It results in the Armageddon earthquake. So we see a relationship on why these were here. The lion, like a lion roaring, it's God's justice. It says they uttered their voices. You see, it's a voiced message. They are thunderous in that they are startling truth that will bring great controversy, because the 7 last plaguing truths expose all the errors, like we went through at the beginning of today's meeting. And the controversies are going to lead to that greatest earthquake. But they're told, John's told, as it were, they uttered their voices. He heard what it was going to be. Think about that. These weren't random thunderings like you think of just the thunderclap. These were voices. They had, verse 4, when the 7 thunders had uttered their voices, he was going to write. So there was intelligible words. These were messages, and he was going to write them now. In other words, these 7 thunders, it was just 7 thunders. He already wrote it, didn't he? If it was just 7 thunders, he wrote that. Let that sink in for a minute. That sounds odd, doesn't it? He writes that he heard 7 thunders. But they uttered their voices. He was going to write what they said. But those are the 7 last plaguing truths. And as brought out, it wasn't time for the harvest message truths to be understood back in the 6th stage of the church, back at the French Revolution time. That was not the time for the harvest message truths. That would come under the 7th trumpet, under that trumpeter, Brother Russell. And that would give us our 7 plaguing truths come from the harvest message. So they will be trumpeted in the future, but not before their time. If these 7 trumpets were just controversy in general, how could John have written what their voices said? You just would have wrote, oh, there's a bunch of commotion and trouble in the world. Well, that's true, and we have a lot of verses that demonstrate that. But this is more defined. Okay, I'll stop talking. Any comments or questions on this? Don't hesitate if it doesn't sound like it's jiving for you. Okay, Brother Dan.
Question, Brother Rick, could you restate the connection with the lion roaring and justice? I missed the complete thought, I think.
Okay. So it's a loud voice. Verse 3, it's a loud voice as when a lion roareth. It seems to emphasize justice. But look at Revelation 15. Revelation 15. And in verse 7, 15:7. It doesn't say lion, but it says, and one of the 4 living creatures gave unto the 7 messages 7 golden bowls full of the wrath of God who liveth forever. And when we studied this, I think we all concurred that this one of the 4 living creatures, one of God's 4 attributes, the one that would been in action to give these 7 last plagues would have been God's justice. So, anywho, Ruth.
I have a note that it would be the Lord's indignation at how they have maltreated his people. And it would be a result of the injustice of it.
Very good. So true. So true. You remember how we read and we've been studying Wednesday night on Daniel 12, that the end of the 1260 years, it was the end of the ability for papacy to continue to persecute the truth and to persecute the truth people, the Lord's Spirit begotten. The papacy lost that power to persecute the way she had during the Dark Ages, in part because of the French Revolution throwing down papacy in France, and in part, maybe even more pointedly, by Napoleon imprisoning the Pope. And nothing happened to Napoleon because of that. So it broke the superstitious power that the popes had over the kings. So that was God's justice there being exercised in France, his retributive judgment. So Ruth's point here is that the seven last plagues are going to be God's complete retributive judgment, his wrath poured out on all the nominal systems, papacy and Protestantism alike, and expose their errors, which will lead to their destruction. Ruth.
Yeah, I should have been more clear. That was the note I had on 10:3. Why is a lion roaring? That the Lord was angry at how they've treated his people up till 1799. And so the reason why we think it's a lion in Revelation 15. Over.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good. Sister Molly.
Brother Rick, I have a question. My brain is not connecting some things all of a sudden. So I just wanted to make sure I have the right thought. So I just have to review it. The seven trumpets and the seven angels are related.
You're asking that?
Are related. But the seven thunders are the seven last plagues, and those are going to be evident during the seventh trumpet period. Is that, even though some of those messages happened throughout those trumpets, the seven, I'm getting a little bit lost in that thought. Are the seven thunders delivered that all becomes those seven last plagues happen during the seventh trumpet period or the seventh trumpet and onward? For some reason, I'm having trouble connecting all of those pieces.
Okay. Well, no, that's why Revelation study is of course a challenge. So the seven stages of the church each had a messenger. And the messengers gave a message for the true church, but sometimes it revealed the condition of the nominal church. When we got to the seven trumpets, we find that there were singular trumpeters. And those trumpeters, we found out, were the same as the seven messengers or angel messengers to the seven churches. So the seven trumpets, each trumpet period of time was directly related to each of the seven churches period of time. First church message, first trumpet. Second church message, seventh trumpet. But we find that the seventh trumpet sounds starting in basically 1874 onward with our Lord's return. When our Lord returned, as we're told in Matthew 24, he would choose a servant that was trying to be faithful and bestow upon him the responsibility and privilege of feeding the fellow servants the meat in due season. That meat in due season for us is also what's known as the harvest message. The harvest message which would go forth, the truth going forth, that separates the wheat from the tares, because we're living at the end of the age or the time of harvesting. Same message. The seven last plagues are truths that are poured out once the 144,000, the bride of Christ, have all proved faithful. And the final feet members are still in the flesh. They're given the privilege of then expressing these great truths in some way that it is heard by the people, that people react because these truths are exposing the errors of the nominal systems. Because God is going to vindicate his character. He's going to vindicate the character of his son, Jesus. And he is going to execute it's his divine wrath. He says his wrath is filled up in the seven last plagues, but it's his righteous indignation. And that, we believe, our truths, and this is, it's going to be, they're going to be truths that what Brother Chris has up, they're going to be the truths that the trumpeters had put forth back in their time, but they only had limited success in exposing the errors. But during the seventh trumpet, when the seven last plagues are poured out, it's forced upon the nominal systems. It's forced upon the people. That's why they're in a bowl and they're poured out. There's no escaping it. So the seven thunders, we think, are going to be their voice. Is a message of truth that'll create the great controversies. But they weren't to be known back in the sixth trumpet period. They had to be wait until the seventh trumpet period when the mystery would be completed. Well, I'm saying a whole lot of words. I hope that's somehow connecting, Sister Molly.
It's really helpful. I think, yeah, it's helpful. I just needed a refresher. I think I lose track of the big picture and I get lost in the details sometimes, and I have trouble panning back and just getting it all lined up again. So I do remember talking about all of those things. Thanks for bringing it back to mind.
Well, that's true and that's good. And in these notes, we had that point about the city of Jericho, how they marched around it the 6 days and the priests blew the trumpet once. And that's showing the message of truth going forth from the antitypical priests throughout the gospel age. But the city didn't fall. But on the seventh day, they marched around the city seven times, blew their trumpets seven times, and then the people gave a great shout. That's the reaction of what happens when the seven last plagues or trumpets are expressed. The people shout, and then the walls of Babylon, well, that was Jericho, fall. Which depicts the fall of Babylon as a city in a great earthquake. Okay. Brother Adi.
So the seven thunders has to happen after the mighty angel comes down and plants his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. And that would be during the seventh trumpet, wouldn't it be?
No. This is in the sixth trumpet. And we were bringing out, when we studied this, we were bringing out that this was symbolic of Jesus exercising authority in the French Revolution to keep things from expanding further throughout Europe. It was a temporary block, but we liked the thought that it's Jesus symbolically being represented as intervening, because he is the one. His face was as the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And he's got the gospel truth and represents it. And, he's the one whose feet are as a pillar of fire, pillars of fire that is showing the strength of persecution upon his feet members, as it were, throughout the age. And, the rainbow, represents that he is, he bears the responsibility of fulfilling the various covenants, particularly the Abrahamic covenant. So it does seem like it demonstrated our Lord. But I see, before I follow up with you, Brother Adi, I see Ruth, you have a comment on that?
Well, putting his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the earth, it appeals to me that he's restraining them from breaking out all across the world, because the French Revolution could have easily spread and burned up all of civilized Europe. So he's restraining those elements by putting one foot one place and one foot the other. It kind of reminds me of holding back the four winds. I don't know if it's exactly the same, but anyway, over.
Yeah, I think it does relate to that. Yeah. So the four winds were held back at the end of the sixth seal, which is the same time period as the sixth trumpet. So, okay. Now, Brother Adi, I know we're not going through it in great detail, but.
No, I remember now that it was the sixth trumpet. But then, these seven thunders happened during the sixth trumpet, or was about to happen, but it was shut down so that it wouldn't, the information wouldn't be available at that time.
Well, they were expressed, but they weren't written, and then it was sealed. So, how it happened with John literally on Patmos, we can't say, but symbolically the John class is not authorized to record what they might have heard.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's part of the symbols. It's sometimes challenging to make it all fit as nicely as one might like. Okay. That's why we're not dogmatic about it. If there's other views, we're certainly sympathetic. Other comments on this Revelation 10? Okay. So we'll leave that picture there. And let's take a look at Ezekiel 9 and 10. And again, we're going to have to call on the brethren's memories from previous studies to help move through this a little bit. This was I'm not going to say Brother Gene Burns agreed with all that we're going to say here, but certainly he was the one that brought to our attention the aspect of Ezekiel, the 10th chapter connection. He was pretty convinced of it, but let's start in Ezekiel 9. And, excuse me, Sister Nithia, can you read there for us?
Yes, brother. Chapter 9, verse 10.
Yeah. Verse 3 through 6. 3 through 6, please.
Okay. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the chariot.
I'm sorry. I have to interrupt you. Sorry. I should have had you start in verse 1 through 6. Sorry.
Okay. He cried also in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, 6 men came from the way of the higher gate, which lieth toward the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand, and one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's ink horn by his side, and they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was, to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's ink horn by his side. And the Lord said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men, that sign and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, go ye after him through the city, and smite, let not your eyes spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly old and young, both maids and little children and women, who come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary. Then they begin at the ancient men, which were before the house.
Okay, so thank you. Do you have any opening comments for us on this?
I can say that here it is talking about the seventh angel, Pastor Russell. That's all I can express.
Okay, that's good. We certainly agree with that. Other comments on what we've read? Ruth.
Well, it was the man clothed with linen with the writer's inkhorn by his side. So I like to think of it more as the truth of Brother Russell's writings, because they're marking Christians throughout the harvest, because like we've never met him, but we're sealed, marked by his writings. And then the other 6 men were listed, part of them were listed in the 6th volume as 6 dangerous oppositions to Christians, page 629, that they, the man was marking, or the truth was marking those that would not be slain. Their faith would not be slain. And then those that are marked, they would survive. They'd receive the mark on their foreheads of the truth. And the others would be killed. Their faith in the ransom would be killed. Over.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Good start. Further comments on this? Brother Chris.
I just want to bring out that, you know, we're talking about the man clothed in linen in our Daniel study, and you heard that to Pastor Russell, and you said that was a messenger of the Lord in Daniel, but what identifies this man clothed in linen isn't so much that he's clothed in linen, which is good, but that he has a writer's ink horn, as Sister Ruth is bringing out. He is actually chronicling the events of his day. And I think that when we get to verse 5, there's an indictment against the non-believers, or chairs, actually. I think they're believers for a large part. I think that would perhaps particularly be the 4th volume of the pastor's writing, where he chronicles all of their shortcomings and showing that they're not really true believers. They're not believing Jesus, they're not following his commandments. They're just so worldly that they're accepting atheism and all that. So I just want to bring that out about a man with a writer's inkhorn. If that was mentioned and Daniel, then we might say, well, how do we fit Pastor Russell in there? But over.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, it's our Friday study. Our Wednesday study. Yeah, good. Other comments on these verses? Well, for time, okay, Brother Dan.
Well, Brother Rick, in verse 2, when we have six men came from the gate and so on, if we apply the symbolism of this number six, just like in Revelation, the 666, six is man's number. So we can understand that it's the writings of men who and their writings destroyed the faith of those, and especially their faith in the ransom sacrifice of Jesus. And it's only those who have sealed in their foreheads the truth of the ransom and all the remainder of the divine plan of the ages, which connects to the ransom, who will not be overtaken by these great delusions, which God does allow because he's proving his saints. But he's provided everything that's needed, especially through the wise and faithful servant that we talked about in Revelation, or in Matthew, the 24th chapter. Over.
Okay, very good. So true. Good. Further comments? So as we're winding down, okay, Ruth, you want to close it up for us?
Well, just in regard to the class that is smitten, old and young, maids, little children, women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary, so that the truth, judgment must begin at the house of God. Brother Russell started his ministry with calling the ministers or the clergy, and all these different ones are the ones that are not sealed, and they're immature Christians, or they're not strong Christians. They're lukewarm class, and they're the ones that will be slain. Their faith will be slain because they didn't have full faith in the brazen altar. Over.
Okay. All right. Very good. So, brother, and we'll revisit this next week because we also want to round out the ninth chapter and get into a little bit into the tenth, where this same man clothed in linen is told to take coals off the altar and sprinkle them over the city, the very city he had just condemned. And we think that relates to the seven last plagues being poured out as part of the harvest message. Next week, Lord willing.